Hi, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to see you. They tell me old Mike's acting up tonight, so if I start having any difficulty hearing, just let me know. If you can't hear, let me know. That'd be a brilliant way to put it. Can't hear? Good Lord. Already? I usually last a little longer than that. Is that better? All right. I'll stay right close to that dude. Delighted to be here. And it's great to see a bunch of old friends. And it's almost like a family reunion here. And it's good. It's not podium platter, not patter. I delighted to be back in one of my favorite places of the world. Not only because it's a great place to visit, but because there's a strong service ethic in place in Northern California. And I am always delighted to be back in this area. I bring you greetings from the Honorable Ray Kay, who used to... Klepper was his maiden name. I just saw him down in Louisiana last month, and he knew I was coming up here, so he said to give fond greetings to all of the folk in this area. It really is good to be here. I'm going to get just a little bit of visiting out of the way, and then we'll get down to the grunting and groaning of this thing. I'm not even going to tell you about the 20-hour flight that I took here. I just soon not even think about it ever again in my entire life. I just simply tell you this, it ain't that far. So I didn't fly much, but I spent an awful lot of time sitting. And then I was greeted at the airport by the beautiful and talented Jeff, and I hadn't seen anything yet. Riding with Jeff was a spiritual experience if I've ever had one. I didn't even know where I was going. He had just come from there, but I could tell he wasn't a creature of habit. Because we went to places he'd never been, and I wound up having to navigate the trip to a place I didn't even know the location. So I'm not even going to tell you about the travel. You can just sort of fill in the blanks. Something else. Two other things I want to get out of the way. I didn't stonewall the countdown. I didn't stand up because y'all may not realize this, but California people talk fast. And by the time they got through with the 40, y'all were already in the 30s. So my sobriety date was last February was 43 years. And... So I would have stood if I had been able to hear and been able to do so. That's an awfully unbelievable thing for me. Other thing, now this is not a commercial, but it may look like one. We did an H&I workshop this afternoon, and I used some notes that some folks wanted to just see if I was really going by what was on there. But there's some folks that want those notes. And I made the mistake of giving them to a drunk. But unbelievably, he came back. Isn't that the truth, Tony? David, where is David? I want to get him to stand for just a minute. Wrong David. No, there he is. That's him. Stand there a minute. Those of you who wanted to get those notes, David is the guy who has them. So... Yeah. Well, he has some copies made, and if you'll let him know if you want to get those, I know that most of you weren't there, but those of you wanted to get those, see? All right. David will be right by these front doors up here. And so anybody wants that, just give him your name, address, email, or slow mail, snail mail, whatever. And he'll take care of getting that there. And thank you, Tony. Good work, buddy. I was really glad to see Tony trusted with a collection plate. That is progress that borders on perfection. Well, now you notice that we didn't start right at 8 o'clock. So don't get nervous at 9 because I won't even be started good by 9. Let me tell you what I want to get at a little bit. I like to remind myself. I have the pleasure and privilege, really, of doing what we're doing here tonight quite a lot. And there's a good thing to that. There's also a downside to it. If I don't watch it doing it so often, if I don't watch it, I'll find myself getting like a trained parrot. And so the minute somebody just says, Tom, I'll just start talking. May not be connected to anything. You know, it's just sort of talking. And when that happens, I think the message is over. And so I like to remind myself periodically, just so I get sensitized to what it is that we're about here tonight. Now, this good time was going on here. I hate to see it broken up with a meeting, but a good time was going on here. That was one of the most enthusiastic countdowns I've seen for a long time, except a young people's convention. And it was one of the best distributions of sobriety I've seen for a long time. That was really neat to see. But I like to remind myself, and bear with me just a minute. I want to kind of bracket, in a way, what I want to keep in mind as we go along, and invite you to join me in that. I like to remember what it is that brings us together. Now, certainly we're going to have a good time here, have had a good time here over the weekend. We'll continue to do so. But I like to remind myself that that isn't why we meet. We'll see a bunch of old friends. That isn't why we meet. You know, what brings us together is a killer illness called alcoholism. I'm one who believes, I've come to believe over the years, that alcoholism is a killer illness. I believe that about 95% of the people on this planet who have alcoholism die of that illness, usually tragically at a very early age. And most of them die never effectively knowing that there's a solution for this illness that's readily available. Overwhelming majority never have any awareness whatsoever that there is a real solution for them. It's really interesting to me that when I came in the program, I came in just about the time alcoholism was alluded to as an illness by the medical association. Really interesting that at the point I came in, the average life expectancy was about 52 years for an active alcoholic. Well, you know what's happened in the last 40 plus years. There's been enormous research, development. There's been a period when treatment was available on demand almost to anybody who would ask for it. We have universities now who teach entire programs in alcoholism or addictionology or something. We have PhDs in the illness. Research has been done, God knows how much. Interesting thing. The average life expectancy of an active alcoholic in the year 2000 is 52 years. And that's what I'm talking about. We're talking about a killer illness that doesn't yield to any sort of just sort of spiffy, cutting-edge thinking. It's a fatal kind of an illness, and it's a peculiar illness. I'll just say one thing more about it. It's a peculiar illness in that it's so persistent. It's an illness that can take me out of here in a heartbeat. And I guarantee you, Dan would tell you that just as quickly as I would at 53 years. Those years give us no immunity whatsoever. I have watched fellows of mine who were senior to me demonstrate for me what happens to alcoholics who let themselves become vulnerable again. It's an illness that'll knock me out in a heartbeat. And I never want to forget that. Nothing needs to happen to make that come about. I don't need to encounter disaster, reversal on the job, divorce, separation, death of a child, death of a parent. None of that need occur. The only thing that needs occur for me to be once again where I came from is to simply stop doing the things that keep me at peace with that illness. Our book refers to that in a special kind of way. It reminds us that what we have in recovery is essentially a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I fully believe that. And all I have to do to revisit active alcoholism is let up on the practice of those principles that give me good, solid grounding. And so I want to remember that. Fortunately, part of the treatment for it is fun. I mean, total enjoyment. And you guys were demonstrating that. But I like to remember that fun is not our objective. It's a celebration of that more fundamental kind of understanding. And so I like to keep that in mind when I visit this thing. I don't ever like to get too cute with it. Don't like to get too academic. I like to be constantly aware of what it is that we deal with. And the fact that I'm sober and have been since the first meeting I walked into 43 years later, to me, is an absolute miracle. It's an absolutely unbelievable phenomenon in my own life. I'll tell you what adds to that. And part of what I want to sort of get at a little bit before I get out of Dodge, my 43rd year of recovery is my very best year. And I mean that. Thank you. That's not just something nice to say. That's an absolute fact. I'm having more fun. I've got more enthusiasm. I've got more ideas firing than I had 40 years ago. And I am having a great time. And so I want to just sort of share with you. I don't understand a lot about alcoholism. There are all kind of theories about it. Everybody's got theories. One of them is that we are just unusually capable people. That we seem to have an intellect superior to average people. That we are a lot more creative, inventive, just daring types of people. That we're sort of stuffed full with talent that's just waiting to burst out. I think that's why Van Gogh cut his ear off, you know, because he just had so much. And we just broke out in alcoholism. That's a great theory. And now I've heard that discussed a lot, but you know the only place I've ever heard it is inside Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe anybody over at Stanford is studying that brilliant extra chromosome brain of the alcoholic. At least I haven't heard of it. But it's a great theory, and there's just enough credence to give it some credibility. Like, for example, I'll just give you a couple examples that kind of make the point to me. Yeah, I'm just an average old redneck boy from down in North Carolina. No real budding genius or anything like that. Just an average guy. And when I went in the military, I was a doofus of the first order. I mean, I made Gomer Pyle look like Sergeant York. I was one goofball soldier. And I loved it for about 30 minutes. And then I met the first boss I was to meet. And Jesus, man, it was over for me. And it went downhill. I mean, I was not a good soldier. I didn't like it. I mean, anything about it. None of it made sense to me. I was down in South Carolina, and we were out marching in knee-deep sand. Everywhere we went. They had 10,000 vehicles sitting there. And all we do is walk. They wash those suckers every day, you know, and line them up. You know, line them up. Absolute band. You don't want to get a radiator cap in front of the other one. Precision snap line stuff. Jesus. Walking with an iron hat in Fresno summer. God. Stupid. Carrying a pack on my back. I don't know what was in it. Didn't care what was in it. I just wanted to put the sucker down. Yeah, we're out there wading in that sand for no good reason. I didn't like it much. But in spite of all that, when we finished basic training out of 1,000 people, they picked out five guys who seemed to have unusual ability, the characteristics of active alcoholism. And they picked out the guys that looked like they had leadership ability, real talent, and were go-getters and leaders of men. And they gave us the opportunity to go for leadership training into OCS, become officers, gentlemen, and leaders of men. Now, that ain't bad, because I was one of the five. And when they called my name, I said, huh? Some of the guys around me said, huh? Because I tell you, the government has no business evaluating talent. They missed bad on that one. And when I went off to the first increment of that and found downtown, they learned what they had. And I spent my military career in ways that reinforced my dislike. I spent my career in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. God almighty. I'm going back up there next year for their convention. I ain't staying, I'll tell you that. Best I remember, I hated that with a purple passion. Isolated, stationed in a place with a whole base full of men. Men. One woman in the whole place. I couldn't even speak to her. She didn't like it. And about half the time I was out in a place called Adak, in the Aleutian Islands. There ain't nothing there. I mean, it's nothing. All it is a big rock out there in the middle of the ocean. Snows sideways there. Wind, miserable place. And I'm standing out there with a gun, and I'm supposed to shoot any Russian that tries to steal that rock, I guess. I'd have given him that sucker with no argument. Man, take it. You got you. Well, I mean, I just plain didn't like it. But now, the remarkable thing. Now, here's a young meathead that's just coming out of nowhere. Never been anywhere in my life. I get into this man's army. I'm picked out of 1,000 people as a budding superstar. 38 months later, I was thrown out with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism. Same army, same soldier, same deal. That's alcoholism. The first year I was out, I was employed in a company selling in the city of Charlotte, our largest city. That year, I was voted salesman of the year and fired the same year. Yeah, that was the story of my life. You know, I was one of those people who had some incredible ability to make good first impressions. And so my pattern was I'd go somewhere looking for a job, and they would hire me for more than I was looking for. They'd want me to run the place. And then I'd go to work and then just kind of work my way down, you know. Then out. Never had a promotion in my life on merit. Never held a job for as much as a year. It was that characteristic of being able to make real good starts and then automatically that great capacity to sabotage the best was always there. And that was the story of my alcoholism. So there is some credence to that story, I guess, in a way. Well, let me just kind of get at it this way. That my life just kind of took off that way. I developed alcoholism. Don't know why. Don't know much about it. I've been to a lot of studies about it. I've read a lot of books about it, seen movies about it. I don't know much about it. I don't understand craving. Not a bit. I don't understand that. But I sure know what it feels like. I don't even understand a mental obsession. But I darn sure know what one feels like. Of all the stuff that I've learned about alcoholism, the only thing that is truly important is that I know I have it. And that's the most important thing I know. And I don't know why. I don't really have a lot of interest in why the steps take me through it. But I don't have a lot of interest in that. I just want to know at a cellular level that I have it. And that's important for me to know. And I really don't know why. I'm a guy that's an average type of guy. But I found myself when I was 24 years old, sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary. That happens with some alcoholics. Thank God not with most. But I found myself sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary. And when I came to my senses, I mean, I don't mean that I didn't know where I was. I knew where I was. But when I came to my senses, you know what I mean? And started to realize what my life had come to. It was unbelievable. You know, I'm sitting, a 24-year-old guy. I'm sitting in a place where I'm confident my life will end. There will never be any more life for me. And I truly did not care. 24-year-old guy. Shortly after I got in there, I was recommended to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went into my first meeting. My last drink was November the 19th of 56. My first meeting was February 2nd of 57. And that's the point where my recovery started. And when I went into that meeting and listened to the first alcoholic I ever heard tell his story, I didn't relate to anything about it. And as I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous and listened to the things going on around me, you know, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old. I didn't think anybody could be an alcoholic at 24. And at that point, back in late 56, early 57, there were no young people to speak of in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it an enormously difficult, uncomfortable place to be. And we talk about identifying, not comparing, as being important. It's important for me to identify with the story, not try to compare stories. Well, that's easier said than done if you're sitting in a meeting and you're outweighed by everybody there. And most of the people in the groups that I went into back then, most of them had been drunk more years than I was years old. And so I'd sit in there looking at my life, and I'd had 8 years of serious drinking. And so when I compared, I always came up short. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I really believed that I was a guy with enormous ability and someday look out world. That's really what I believed. And so I sat and listened in Alcoholics Anonymous. What it sounded to me like when I first looked at it, I'd hear somebody tell their story, and we know what we're saying, but we don't know what folks are hearing, eh? That I would listen to somebody tell a story. What it sounded to me like they said they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. Well, my God, if that's what it is, I've had that all of my life. Because I've been in trouble all my life. And I've never been in any real trouble sober, never got thrown out of the army sober, never went to jail sober. You know, I've been to jail God knows how many times because I sure don't. Never been sober. You know, I like to think that I went to jail the exact right number of times. Exactly the right number. Yeah, I'm not like a fellow I met a while back. I did a talk at one of those court honor programs where the judge has drunks come in that they've captured and they do something to them. And they want me to come in and harangue them, so I did. And I went in, I remember a fellow introduced me to me at the start of the meeting. Finished the meeting, he came back over to me and he said what he had to say, and then he said, "Do you know me?" I said, "Well, you told me who you were a while ago." He said, "No, I don't mean that." He said, "I mean, do you know me? Do you recognize me from television or magazines or anything like that?" I said, "No, I'm sorry, but I don't." And he kind of drew himself up with pride. And he said, "I happen to be the most arrested man in the United States of America." He said, "According to record, I've been in jail more than any other human in this country." Well, I mean, I was a little nonplussed at that. I mean, what do you say to a guy? So I just kind of looked at him a minute, and I said, "Well, congratulations." I don't think I was at his ballpark. I don't want to know. I think it was enough. Yep. And so when I looked at my life, that's what I saw, was just constant trouble over and over and over again. So I could see that there was big trouble there. You know, add to that the fact that I was serving a sentence of 15 years for a crime that I had absolutely no recollection of committing then, now, ever. But one of those things that just happens sometimes in alcoholic blackouts. I've never known an alcoholic who hasn't had pretty morbid fear about doing great damage. And thank God for most alcoholics, those fears are bad dreams. But sometimes they're real nightmares. And so I was serving a sentence of 5 to 15 years was the actual sentence for a crime for which there's actually no adequate punishment. No adequate punishment. I had blind drunk, blacked out, driven a car down the main street of a large city, and it run down and killed two people. And so I was serving a sentence for that crime. I have no recollection, but no doubt whatsoever that that's exactly what I did. And there is no punishment for that. There is no adequate punishment for that. So I'm sitting there not only troubled with the resistance for not understanding the condition, for thinking I was too young, but living under a veritable mountain of guilt, a mountain of guilt. I felt deeply ashamed to even be breathing when two fine young folks no longer were because of me. And I'll guarantee you, I don't care how deranged you are, you don't balance those scales. And so when I look at that and look at what it took to turn that life around, I'm absolutely convinced of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the only thing that really made the big turn in my life was this process of surrender at Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't think I fit. Thought I was too young, thought I was too smart, but just kept going. And then finally, I started listening to speakers a little bit more deeply and started to understand that they were not alcoholic because they drank too much and got in trouble. They were alcoholic because there was something different about the way they related to drinking, that they drank when it was totally against their wishes. And then slowly I started to understand that it was not about how long I had drunk. It was not about how many times I'd been in jail. It was not about how many times I had my nose broke, how many times I woke up somewhere in the wrong state. Not about that. Not how many times I woke up married to somebody I didn't even know. Not about that. I only did that once. But that's more than the average social drinker does it, I'll tell you that. But it's not defined by that. It's not defined by how much I drank. You know, those are not the things that define. The thing that defines my alcoholism that started too slowly there was recognizing that when I took a drink, something happened to me that was different. I want to read one thing because it says it so much more clearly and succinctly than I could. But I want to say that because the turning point in my life that was so critically important had to do with that whole business of getting down to cases with my illness. And there's a place in the third chapter that's my favorite place in the book because that's where I think recovery starts. You know, ours is not a program that we tend to get because of attainment or success or that kind of thing or bold new ideas. Our recovery, that in fact every recovery that I've ever seen that was long-lasting and solid comes out of the bitter crucible of defeat. I've never known a successful long-term recovery that was not born out of surrender. And the way our book describes it is this way, and it describes my alcoholism better than anything could. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Here's the key for me. We learned that we had to fully concede, good word, to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And no matter how many goofy, crazy antics that went on, the whole story of my life is wrapped up in that. I'm somebody who simply does not relate to booze like other folk do. I want to visit the steps just for a minute and tell you what was so critically important in me starting to get into a program of recovery. I really didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I really did believe I was too young, and I really was the youngest guy in every meeting I attended for several years, youngest member in my entire state for several years. And that's really an awkward place to be. And I tell you, when I started listening to that thing, what really came down, I'm a very simple thinker. I like to keep stuff at a very simple level so I can understand it. And when I think about things like craving and obsession and unmanageability and powerlessness, I like to reduce that down to very simple things. Powerless is what I do if I take a drink. I used to hear people in those early days talk about it's the first drink that gets you. And I thought that was the goofiest thing I had ever heard grown folks say. Nothing happened to me when I had one drink. Sounded to me like alcoholics were people who had a drink and then had a running fit or something. They'd just kind of go crazy or fall out kicking. Well, I never did that. When I took a drink, all I did was take another drink. And then another one. And then I'd wake up in Georgia somewhere. In jail, usually. Yeah, I didn't understand that powerlessness to mean simply that. Powerless is what I do if I take a drink. Well, that's good enough in and of itself. The good news is this. That will never mean one single thing to me if I don't take a drink. It'll never bother me. It'll never show up. I had an MRI just recently that I don't know what for. I think they needed the money or something because there wasn't nothing wrong. And so they ran me in that tube and examined my head and they didn't find a thing in there. And then they pulled me out. Now, when they pulled me out, nobody said, "My God, look, this boy's an alcoholic." Yeah. There it is, right over there by his gizzard. You know, it's sitting in front of me. Nobody said that. To any observer, I look and act just like any other human being in concern to the physical aspects of alcoholism. It'll never bother me unless I do one thing, and that's have a drink of anything with alcohol in it or any close cousin. And if I do that, I'm history. Now, that's critical for me to understand about alcoholism, that I am not like other drinkers, and I'm not going to be, in the sense that all these years later, if I take one drink, I have no question whatsoever that I'm dead meat, that I'm right back where I left off at least. The other thing, and the thing that keeps me moving in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the other part of that, the unmanageability. You know, anybody can understand, I think, what happens if you take a drink. That's obvious to see. Where alcoholism comes into the picture that's troubling to me and what keeps me driving in Alcoholics Anonymous today is what happens when I don't take a drink. A non-alcoholic by the name of Bill Silkworth wrote about that. And he referred to it in a lot of ways. He called it the peculiar mental twist of the alcoholic. He referred to it as that strange thinking that precedes the first drink. Let me tell you what that means to me, is that my alcoholism is well defined by what happens if I don't drink. I think back to those days when I used to stop drinking. Did that with great regularity. I quit drinking a lot, never did do well at staying there. And what would happen normally when I would stop drinking, I'd feel good. My morale would go up. I'd start getting righteous. I'd quit chasing girls, want to quit smoking, quit cussing, quit hanging around bad people. It'd last for a couple of weeks. And then something would happen. I would find myself sitting somewhere in my house, cleaned it up, all that kind of stuff, and just kind of be ill at ease. You know what I mean? Not mad. Not upset about anything, not worried about anything, just find myself kind of at loose ends and be antsy. Get up and look out the window. For what? Couldn't sit down, couldn't stand up, couldn't read a book, couldn't watch television, pick up the phone to see if it's working. He called it restlessness, irritability, and discontent. That strange frame of mind that precedes the first drink. Now, what I would do with that, I'd get to a certain point, then I'd say, well, I think I'll go up and hang out with the guys a little bit in my old watering hole. Not to drink, of course, But I'm going to just hang out up there and go up there and heroically tell everybody I've quit drinking forever and would last for maybe half hour. Now, I didn't do that once. I didn't do that a dozen times. I did that God knows how many times. And never understood that until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a good while. Very important for me to understand that. That's the crucible. Very, very important for me to understand that deeply, that that's the kind of dude I am. Well, I am so grateful for the way our program goes about dealing with a guy like this, because it follows immediately with that just abject declaration of surrender, of defeat, with the introduction of hope. And when I look at the first three steps in our program, it basically has to do with one thing. Two things. One, it has to do with my surrender at depth, that the personal deal, a personal surrender. Then it has to do with having a relationship with the power. Now, I know a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who, in fact, I know a good number of people who have never pretended to work anything in the program. I've met a number of people who've never read the book nor plan to. There is no one way that we do this thing. We're not producing clones. A lot of people that work the first three steps in the program and call it a halt. Now, that's okay. I've seen that happen, but I'm not somebody who envies them because I think it's a bad place to stop. If all I was interested in was how to survive on a daily basis, that would be perfectly okay. But it doesn't have too much to do with recovery. It has to do with surviving and getting through life. The part that I need to get into are the next group of steps that start to give me a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. 4 through 7 are the steps that have to do with my relationship with myself. I want to just hit it this way for a couple of minutes. I think there's a turning point or several turning points in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there certainly was for me. The turning point for me that mattered most and still does this day was the thing that happened in the fourth step. And I don't think there's any most important step. We got 12 of them. But that was truly a turning point for me. I was getting active in the program by then. I was sober for several months. I've always been a reader. I'd read all the stuff we had. Went to a meeting one day, didn't mean to do anything life-changing, and sat down and listened to the speaker. He was a guy who came in from the town I was sentenced from, and he spent the entire meeting talking about nothing but the fourth step. Went into great detail about it. He stressed the importance of writing the inventory. When he got through, I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I went back to my cell, and I knew the words, but there's a big difference between the words and the action. And so I sat down and started to write. Now, I'll tell you where I was at that point. Now, this is a kind of a sad story. It'll tear your heart out. But my family broke up when I was 4 years old. Dad left, and I knew when he left he wasn't coming back. Didn't know where he was going, but I knew he wasn't coming back. And then the real bad news was that my mother remarried a short while later to a little old runt of a guy by the name of Alvin. And I swear to God, I despised that dude the day he drove up. I mean, I slam couldn't stand him. One of the most obscene people I have ever seen in my life. Now, I don't mean his language. I mean, he was just a slug of a man. If you shake hands with that sucker, you'd want to go wash or something. Yeah, he was just a nasty cat. And when he came, I was young enough, I had to call that thing Daddy. And I had she used to be an older sister. We're now twins for some reason. But she called the thing Alvin. Well, I swear, every day of my life, I just burned at that cat. And promised myself, if I ever got big enough, I was going to whip him out of sight. Then I went off to the army, and I came back. I was too big. You can't whoop a dwarf, you know. I know that. I'll always be one of my frustrated. I never did get to whip that old fool. He died. And I tell you, I don't even like him dead. I really don't like that cat. Yeah. To the untrained eye, that would look like a resentment. And Maybe, but I'm going to keep it. I'll tell you that. I mean, I didn't like it. You know. Well, I go down to where he's buried every once in a while and check on him, just make sure he hadn't dug out. You know. And I was at a point where I was thinking, well, my God, anybody who grew up under that kind of distorted and influence would have to be a little weird, and I was. And so what I meant to do was sit down and write a little story about Alvin, life's cruelty and all that stuff. Founders were wise when they said to write it. Because I sat down and started to write what I had in mind, and with no intent whatsoever. I wrote about two lines, and then with absolutely no thought, preparation, or intent, it was like the dam broke. And I just absolutely unloaded everything in my life that came out in just a rush. And then a few minutes later, well, a little more longer than that, but not too much time later, I was finished with three pages of scrawl on a yellow legal pad. Wasn't much of a piece of work by literary standards. Wasn't much of an analysis by psychological standards. Certainly wasn't much of a diagnosis by medical standards, but I'll tell you what it was. It was the most important day's work I have ever done in my entire life, bar none. Because that day, something fundamentally important happened to me. One, I knew that I was alcoholic. Period. Not the alcoholic who was a tragic case or the whiz kid or the great winner in the making. Nothing. I knew I was alcoholic. 43 years later, I have never doubted that for one second. Not one second. That was resolved at depth. I knew I was alcoholic. Never doubt. I've come close to drinking a few times. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't used to be. I am an alcoholic. And so I've never doubted that. Also happened that day was I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't sign anything. You don't have to sign anything. Easiest fellowship in the world. Join if you're a member, if you say you are. And you're a member till you either quit or take a drink. Easiest one to resign from. And I have never been the same from that day to this. I've never gone to a meeting without knowing exactly why I'm there, including this one. See, it grounded me in a program that was based on reality. Now, there were some things that flowed out. Now, I'm not an analysis freak. A lot of people think you want to do inventories ad infinitum. I'm not one of them. I've been 43 years. I've done 2 3/4 inventories. And if the need comes up, I might do another one. But I've done 2. That one was that sort of cathartic emotional experience that I just described. And the other one was later on, where I did a fifth step with a fellow member, and the next one I did the more thoughtful thing with the outline, and started to understand something about, you know, what the diagnosis of alcoholism meant. And that time I took a fifth step with a professional who was not in the program. But anyway, that's been it. And then the 3/4 was just a particular crisis kind of thing I needed to do some real looking at. And otherwise, that's it. Fundamentally important to me. Fundamentally important. Yeah, I found, and I won't dwell, I'll just mention it, but what I found was that defects of character, when I first considered defects of character, I thought that was the goofy stuff I did, the behaviors that I did. But when I started to do that 4-step, I started to understand that defects of character had to do with how I was made up, how I was constituted as a human being. See, if at the surface level, you know, I might lie to you. But that was not the defect of character, that was a behavior. The defect of character was that I was a liar, constitutionally dishonest, it appeared to be. I wasn't somebody who had to plan to lie. I was somebody who instinctively lied. I have to plan to tell the truth. You know, I put it in the past tense. I'm still that way. I guarantee you, if I fail to do something, my first instinct will not be to blurt out the truth. My instinct will be to lie. And I have to practice the principle of honesty. It doesn't come natural. And so defects of character were what drove my life. And I started to understand that when I said I was an alcoholic, I was talking a lot more about a guy who drank and got in trouble. I started to understand something about what drives this machine and what it's going to take to become free. In the fifth, that tremendous experience in the fifth. And when I tell you, aside from all the stuff it says in the book, I'll tell you the one thing that was tremendously important that came clear to me there. That was the first crack in the wall of self-centered isolation that had been my prison forever. The prison I was in when I did that step was nothing compared to the prison of my life. And I started to understand that alcoholism is about a human being losing the ability to live as they would. So that started to be understood. And the first human that ever had a peek at my life, ever, was the guy I did that fifth step with. First crack in that wall. What a powerful thing. Six and seven were places where some tremendously important stuff happened. When I first started looking at those things, I thought they were filler material. Really did. Looked like a rehash of what we'd just done. And then when I got into that, I started to see that this was a tremendously pivotal place in the program. Let me ask you to think about something. If you're somebody who works with people intensively in the steps, think of somebody that you've been working with and felt like you had some progress going on. Take a look at where you lose them. Take a look at where you lose them. You know, I believe, no basis for this other than just what I believe, but like we talk about crossing a line into alcoholism, I think we cross a line in recovery. And if we do, I think it comes at the point of six and seven. Because up until then, what we've done is talked about, you know, deep-seated personal stuff that's an inside job. No real evidence to it, no real decision. It's just acceptance of stuff. And then say four and five, we're getting to acquainted with who we are. And then what six and seven presents to me is one of our old North Carolina boys says it's decision time. I've taken a look at the illness. I know what it's about. And I understand for a change what the issues are. And it comes home simply to me that it's this. Do I want to change or don't I? Do I want to get well or don't I? Do I want to become free or don't I? And if so, there's a process by which that can happen. So it's a critical decision point. And then 8 through 12 is to me where the freedom and the joy come from. I won't say much about amends other than this. I obviously had some deep and troubling amends that were difficult to make. I won't go into detail about the obvious one of taking somebody else's life. I'll just tell you this. It gets a little heavy for what we're doing here tonight, but if there's anybody who's trouble with that, I can tell you for sure that our program will be equal to giving you what you need to get through it and make amends as much as they can possibly be made, enough that you can be free. And so if anybody's got trouble in that area, and I run into it a lot, I'll be happy to talk with you if you're having a problem with that. Otherwise, to me, what I like to think about in amends are not the dramatic things, the big things, not the money things so much. It's recognizing what amends is about. When I started looking at the wreckage of my past, started looking at amends, what I recognized was that every time I used, abused, misused, screwed over, took advantage of, out-slicked somebody, I wasn't a winner, I was a loser. Because every time I did that to a human, I paid for that with a piece of my soul. And I fully believe that I will never be a free man until I go back and amend those warped and distorted relationships. I have got to get free from the wreckage of the past, and I've got to get to a point where I can look the world in the eye and meet my fellow man. Great freedom is represented in that. And then the last three, are some people call it maintenance steps. I sure don't. They're the steps that bring about the new life. You know, I've often wondered why on earth, and I can't answer it, but why on earth would a guy like me be given the gift of recovery? I think there's a real responsibility goes with it, and it's part of the amends process. But, yeah, I believe this. For every one of us, and it's just my belief, doesn't make it right, but I believe this, that for every one of us who does this program of recovery, who practices these principles as a way of life, I think for every one of us, an avenue of service will open up. And nobody knows what it's going to be. If some people may be speaking in meetings or chairing meetings or treasurer or making coffee at a home, who knows what it's going to be? God, there's no end to the services that can be done. I believe that every one of us has a story that somebody needs to hear. Somebody needs to hear your story, not mine, yours. And so I believe that in the course of doing these steps, in the course of practicing these principles, an avenue of service will open. And it's in these steps that that becomes a fact. You know, 10 to me is a vital thing just for keeping the rudder in the water and for staying even with the world so I don't get behind and need to do massive inventory and stuff like that. It's about maintaining this way of life, living by these principles. And then 11 to me is where the action happens. When I first looked at that, I thought it was a deep meditation step where you'd go sit on the dock and stare at your navel or something. That's what I thought it was about. And then I started to understand a little differently. Because what it says is that we come to become. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand. Praying only for knowledge of will for us, power to carry it out. Certainly has to do with the quality of the relationship. You know, I'm a practical guy. I'm not a theological type of guy. I'm not a mystical kind of guy. I'm a guy who believes what it says in the book, that the spiritual life's not a theory, we have to live it. I want my spiritual life to be functional in everything that I do. I want my spiritual life to be with me, guiding me as we try to find our way back to the airport. And maybe we'll make it. I want that very much. I want it to be on my job. I want it to be on the freeway. I want it to be in my interactions with you. My spiritual life, and I'll tell you, I used to hear people talk about that, and I thought they were talking about being zombies. But now I'm one of them. And God, what a great feeling it is to be able to trust and just let life happen. And what I believe is that in that step, where it says praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it, is where that avenue of service is going to come to us. Now, this is my belief, all it is. But I believe that when I get to that point of recognizing the avenue of service or recognizing a service that needs to be done, the quality of my recovery, without question, will be directly impacted by how I respond to that avenue of service. If I selfishly back off in fear or pride or resignation or whatever, I'll be the loser. I'll shortchange myself. See, I don't believe that recovery comes from just finding a comfortable place in the box that I brought here. I think it becomes very important to stretch. I love to see somebody, we most of us do, I love to see somebody get up to read or speak shaking like a leaf. And it's not because I enjoy somebody's suffering, but it's because I enjoy that great feeling of pulling for them. Pulling for them. I saw a guy try to read How It Works. Took him forever. And I swear to God, the scariest man I ever saw. Only man I've ever seen got a standing ovation for reading How It Works. We're a peculiar bunch. Yeah. And how tremendously important it is. I tell you this, one reason I feel strongly about that. When I came in this program, I was as paralyzed with withdrawal and isolation as anybody I have ever met. And I've worked with a ton of drunks. But I was absolutely as withdrawn, as isolated, as fearful as anybody I've ever met. And listen to what I'm saying now. I learned the value thanks to people pushing me, guiding me, directing me, I learned the value of stepping through that curtain of fear. And every time I stepped through that curtain of fear, it got a little bit thinner and a little less formidable. Now, I still have to do that. I'm not a natural extrovert. I'm not a natural speaker. I'm not a natural guy that takes charge. I'm somebody who has learned that my options are this. I either stay inside that prison or I take that little step into what brings the freedom. And to me, that's where the great adventure. You know, there's a place in the book where it says some things that sound almost euphemistic in a way. The place in there where it says we'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension. Man, that's something, isn't it? That sounds like San Jose. Rocketed into a fourth dimension. That's big stuff. That our imagination will be fired. Wonder what brings that about. Wonder how many years of dry it takes to fire your imagination. I don't think there are enough years to be dry to fire your imagination. In all honesty, the only thing I ever got out of being dry was sobered up and, just like the book says, dull, gloomy, and boring. Didn't fire my imagination. All I did was revert back to that same miserable cat. And what fires my imagination is getting caught up in this program as a way of life, so that it becomes a vibrant, dynamic thing that's operational in my life. That's why I say at 43 years, I'm having my best year. And I've got more things going on than most folks I know. And absolutely loving the experience. Absolutely loving this experience. And so that's what this is about. Then the 12 is about the business of three things, really. One is, it assures me that I will have a spiritual awakening if I do what's in those 200 words in the steps. That I'll have a spiritual awakening. I'll have an awakened spirit. I'll have a change in the way I react to this world. And I'm here to tell you that's the truth. That's not a false promise. That's the truth. And then, having had that happen, that I try to carry the message to others in any way that I can. And God knows there's no limit to that. And what a tremendous treat. The other says to practice principles in all our affairs. I just mentioned this one thing about that. Yeah, I'm a guy. Now, there's nothing heroic in this. It's just a matter of fact. I'm a guy who's been active in this program, as active as anybody I've ever met, for as long as anybody I've ever known. Now, I'm just like anybody else. You know, I have a career. I have a family, have children, I have all the stuff that people have. I have problems, heartbreak, sorrows, illness, I have all of that. Sometimes people will tell me that I'm doing some heroic thing when I come, as much as I do this. Some people tell me I'm doing heroic stuff. Not so. If there's any heroics involved, it's the folks sitting in my house. See, every time I do this, I leave a wife with the total responsibility for everything that goes on in our house. And thank God she is supportive and believes in why I do it. Thank God. She was telling me about it. Somebody asked her one night, said, "Why on earth is your husband gone all the time?" And she said, "Well, he's real active in the program." And, you know, told her what I did. And the woman said, "Why don't you make him quit or slow down?" And my wife, I wouldn't take $1 million for what she said. She said, "Well, there's two reasons. One is he won't. And the other is I like our life." And I'll tell you this, I know that in this group tonight, there are people who are deeply committed to service. And I know that every time anybody gets real active in this program, you have that kind of ambivalent feeling about how much is too much. And is it fair to my family to do this? And am I going to be hurting somebody by that? We all go through that. Think about what I said, and it's a God's truth. I've been as active as anybody I know for as long as anybody I know. And if there is anything in any significant area of my life that has been negatively impacted one iota, I don't know it. We're into almost our 33rd year of continuous marriage, and it's still... I wouldn't have bet on 33 days with a guy like me. And she'll tell anybody that if it were not for Al-Anon, that would have never happened. And I was sober 11 years. She has no earthly... She believes about my active drinking days, but she is no witness to that. What she found was the vital quality of Al-Anon in recovery. Not in getting over drunk, but in recovery. And learning how to deal with this strange kind of life that we're in. And she truly has become part of that. She's a good, strong member. Not negatively impacted. Two kids who both finished the university system and done pretty well. My daughter's still searching for her star, but yeah, she graduated from the university in psychology. And I told her to stay out of that. She's learned why I told her that. And so she's trying to get attached back to this planet, you know, and you get it. But she'll make it. She's a good girl. And then my son, I was really disappointed with him. That boy had the makings of a member. He really did. He just showed all of the great stuff that alcoholics show. We went off to college. He majored in fraternity the first year and went on a class trip to Jamaica, and he was elected King Reggae of Jamaica. And my wife was properly chagrined about that, and she said, "Can you believe he went down there?" And I said, "Yeah, God, isn't that awful?" And inside, I was saying, "Yeah." Go get him, boy. I mean, he looked like a comer. You know, that old Brando said, "I could have been a contender." Yeah, that boy could have been a fine member. Yeah, I could just see him taking those buckets around and putting an arm on folk. And I don't know what happened. I mean, he just lost it somewhere. And in the second year, he decided to go to school. And then 3 years, got his grades up adequately to get into medical school, finished that. Finished his residency, and he's now at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York doing a high-risk fellowship in fetal maternal stuff, whatever it is. I think it means they pay him a lot of money, is what that means. Well, the point is that with the level of activity, not only has it not been injurious, but it's been enormously helpful in every possible way. The first major accomplishment my son had as a physician was with an alcoholic who was extremely suicidal. And all he did was share what he knew, and that woman had a major turnaround. So, point is that these principles will not impact with anything. And everything in my life has been tremendously enhanced. I'm going to close up around this idea. Well, it's not an idea, it's just this thing. People really get on my case if I don't bring some closure in terms of, I think every recovery is unbelievable. When one of us self-declared hopeless cases makes a real turnaround and becomes a solid member of society again, I think it's a miraculous thing to see. And certainly that was my experience. When this program kicked in for me, started to work, and these principles started to take place in my life, take effect in my life. They worked. They worked for me inside a maximum custody penitentiary as well as they've ever worked anywhere. So much so that I became a free man when I was locked up like a wild animal at a zoo and I became free. First day of unadulterated joy I ever had in my life was in a maximum custody penitentiary. This program will work for you. I don't care where you are. These are principles that are powerful. And so it got me turned on to living while I was still in there. Somebody invented television while I was drunk, and I woke up. There it was. And Michigan State University started sending their college to the prison on television. And you could be a freshman at Michigan State by just paying tuition, buying some books. And so I did that. I finished 2 years of my college education in a maximum custody joint. A strange thing. You hear some marvelous stuff in AA. Some of it sounds goofy. But one day I was sitting in a meeting. Now, I know that none of y'all ever did this, but I was not an absolutely pure, chaste alcoholic. I had some other deviations I'm a drunk. But I was a kind of garbage can drunk. Yeah, I'd take anything that looked like it had anything to do with stuff. And I was a sort of a speed freak. I wasn't hooked on it particularly. I was just hooked on extending the party. And I took an awful lot of speed. And I tell you, I don't know how it affects you, but I'd come off one of those running crazy deals after 3 or 4 days and I looked like a raccoon, you know. My eyes would just be dark circles around there. And man, that stuff did something to me. I mean, it fried some stuff in my head pretty bad. And when I got sober and started coming to my senses at that penitentiary, I discovered something. I couldn't sleep in a dark room. Well, that's a little disturbing to find out. You know, I'm sitting in there with 6,000 guys thinking they're all going to want to marry me. And so I didn't want to say something wimpy like, well, I'm afraid of the dark, you know. Yeah, folks were saying, come on, I'll take care of you, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's a troublesome thing when you're a grown man. And I wasn't afraid of the dark. It's just when I'd get in a dark room, my head would just come alive. And I'd look like a kaleidoscope with colors and sounds and stuff. Well, that went on for a long time. And one day I was sitting at a meeting over at the group, and the speaker said profound words. He said, if you can't sleep, stay awake. I thought, God, what a concept. Well, that made eminent sense. I finished 2 years at Michigan State University while I couldn't sleep. And it passed. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Just the simple logic of this thing. Well, I got out eventually, deadly committed to never going through that again. And what I meant was that I would do anything. And I had I'll share these with you and then get on the plane. It's unbelievable what happened. You know, I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen in recovery. And I know that there's some people sitting here who wonder if there's any future whatsoever. And for any of you who happen to be, and I know some are, happen to be in that position, let me just offer this. You know, I'm nobody special. I'm exactly who I told you I was. I was just a garden variety yo-yo. I was a drunk before I was ever anything. I wasn't somebody who had stature and lost it. I never had any. And so what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous was not restoration to a previous condition. I found a whole new life altogether. And so when I left that institution, the only thing I wanted was just simple little dreams. I wanted to be free. I wanted to have honest work. I wanted to be part of a community. I never had been. All I'd ever done was destroy communities. And so when I hit the ground, that's what I had dreams about. And I'm here to tell you, dreams come true. They really do. Because when I hit there, I had employment. I had a job 3 years before I was eligible to get out. I knew if somebody held up to parade, I didn't want it to be me. And so I had a job in North Carolina, lousy job, but I was deeply grateful for it. The second week I was out, guys in my group were working with a small prison over near there, and they said, why don't you go with us? I said, man, they're not going to let me in there. They may not let me out. And they said, it's okay, come on. And so we did. Second week I was out, I'm going back as a visitor to a penitentiary. And... It was a great feeling going in there, and an even better one coming back out. I promise you that. And 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that. Now here, think of the quantum leap from being locked up like a wild animal and then in a position of trust and responsibility, being a servant to this kind of thing. What a tremendous thing. About the same time, my pro supervisor came to me one day and said, "Tom, you're real active in this AA thing." I said, "Yes, sir." And it concerned me because I thought he was going to tell me to stop, and I knew I wouldn't. He said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't," as if he didn't know. When I left Michigan, in letters that big on my papers, this man said, "Never drive a motor vehicle. This man has never drink alcoholic beverages." Those were absolute facts of life. I had no questions about it. Well, didn't work that way. I told him, and he said, "Well, let me take a look at it." Gave me a call a little later and asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown. That sounds like Mayberry, but it's exactly the way it happened. It happened to be Sears was where the driver's license agent was. Got my sister to drive me up there. We parked in front of the place. The story is absolutely true. No flowering up. I could see my guy at the back of that store walk back there. He introduced me to a fellow I didn't know who happened to be the driver's license guy. We chatted for a little while. The guy handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. No test, road, written, verbal, otherwise. None. Didn't even pay for it. Now, you know that that's impossible. That just can't happen. I've had folks tell me I must have been well connected politically. Sure was. Sheriff of that county and I were good friends, old acquaintances. I tell you what, I truly believe. If I had been trying to manipulate that into happening, I would be walking today. I fully believe that. I further believe that when God's got work for us to do, I don't believe it, I know it. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what they are. I know that. I know that on the strength of my own experience, that God knows how many more. 5 months after that, I was DCM. I've always been strong in service. I still am. DCM, 2 years after I was out, I was sitting in my house one day, got a call from the state capitol. A guy introduced himself. I'd met him once. He came to the A group that I sponsored. And he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." And the first thing I told him, I said, "Man, do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yeah, we probably know you better than you know yourself." And to him I said, intellectually, "God, I'd rather do that than anything I know." And that was true. But deep down inside, you know what I said. There ain't no way. There'd never been an ex-con in history hired anything like that. And I knew they weren't going to start with me, but they did. And I was employed as a rehabilitation supervisor in that system. And I'm just wrapping. That's a weird position when you're the only one around. But what a tremendous thing. What a tremendous thing. And I'm just finishing up my 39th year in that pretty quick. And I'm retiring. And believe it or not, nobody believes it, but I'm actually going to do it. And what a tremendous thing that's been. Started out in rehab. I did bother to finish my education and do some stuff like that. And one day the head of our system asked me to come by his office and said he had an assignment he wanted to talk to me about. So I went by. Normally he would want me to pinch hit for him somewhere. And he said, "Tom, I would like for you to take over an institution as warden." And when I got up off the floor, I said, "Boss, I don't want to do that, man. I don't want to be the man. I don't want to be the keeper. I want to mud wrestle with the guys." And then he told me what he had in mind. I said, "Well, give me some time to think about it." He gave me 5 minutes. And I took the 5 minutes, went out, walked up and down the hall, went to the bathroom, prayed hard, and said, "Okay, I'll do it." And that started an unbelievable career. It's a strange position. I don't know of anybody recruiting wardens out of penitentiaries, and I think you know I didn't get recruited there. And when I went to work in that profession, I took it on as a professional. And I didn't want any slack or notoriety because of my history. I put myself on the line. And now I'm not somebody who believes in marketing wounds too much. And so I bothered to finish my education in correctional administration, and also bothered to outwork anybody I've ever met. Tremendous career. Put in about 39 years, but about 20 of that was as a warden. And my basic MO was, the pattern of my career, was I was a guy who developed new facilities and had the opportunity to do some real innovative stuff in my state that I believe needed to be done. And so it's obviously been a tremendously meaningful thing to me. And I hope to you, because no matter how great that future looks, I want you to know that there's hope, and don't question it. There's hope. Whatever you do, just give. All I did was give my life to the simple program, and it gave me back more than I ever dreamed. I'm a regular guy, just an ordinary fellow who's had truly extraordinary experiences. And otherwise, I'm just a walking around guy. I live in the smallest place I've ever lived in my life, and the best. Good place. And I'm a citizen there, up to the hilt, a good citizen. Pay taxes, vote on a regular basis. And I vote if I don't even know who I'm voting for. I just go, because I remember when I couldn't. Got that family that's there, and I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't used to be. I still am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not because I'm bored and have nothing to do. I find here the vital kind of experience that's so important in my life. And I guess the thing I want to do, and the thing I want to ask you to just sort of think with me a little bit about, I think all of us have things we worry about in AA. I certainly do. And when I take a look around at the fellowship and start looking at things that cause me concern, I have to take a look at what I can do. And when I look around at the things that need done, I'm somebody who has some pretty fundamental groups. I believe in well-structured, purposeful groups. I believe that's the basic unit of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm committed to that. And so when I start thinking about what can I do as an individual about the things that concern me in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are just three or four things that I think of. One is that I can be the best member I know how to be. I can stay well informed so that I can enter into discussions about matters of importance in the fellowship. I can be active and support a strong home group. And I do that. I've got one of the strongest home groups I've ever been to. I can do that. I can be involved in service at all levels, and I certainly am. I'll retire from corrections next month. I'll go to work as the H&I chair for the state of North Carolina the same month. You know, so I'm gonna do is just quit getting paid, and I just keep on doing the same kind of stuff. I can do that. The way I look at it is this, and I'd like for you to just kind of put yourself in this picture, if you would. The way I look at it, when I came into AA, we had somewhere around 125,000, 150,000 members. And when I walked in, somebody just like him reached out and took my hand and said, "Come on, guy, walk with us." And I held on to that guy, and I walked. And then a little while later, somebody else came in, and I reached out and took their hand. And I became 125,001, and she became 125,002. And that chain reaction of love and service is what this is all about to me. Every one of us is a link in that chain, whether we want to be or not. I'm a link. My consideration is what kind of link I want to be. Am I going to be somebody who makes the chain stronger? Am I going to be somebody who makes it weaker? Am I going to be selfish enough to let it stop with me? I don't want to do that. I want to be somebody who brings something to this chain reaction and makes a difference in it. My responsibility self-imposed. My commitment is to see that the next boy or girl, man or woman, who comes into a group that I'm part of, gets as good as I got. How could I justify anything less? Thanks.